Before we get started, I need to thank a new Patreon patron. Thank you, Randy Woodland, for becoming a patron of the original cast, and you have joined at a spectacular time because 2024 is, of course, the year of Barbara Harris, and we are flying through the films of Ms. Barbara Harris, our Tony Award-winning, Academy Award-nominated star of the year. We've already talked about Secondhand Hearts, The Seduction of Joe Tynan, and by the time this comes out, the North Avenue Irregulars, we've still got Freaky Friday, Family Plot, Nashville, so many great movies to come, Plaza Suite, Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hungry in the Closet and You're Feeling So Sad, and A Thousand Clowns, all these movies forward to come. And of course, all the archives of all previous 70 plus episodes of the original cast of the movies are yours simply by going to patreon.com/originalcastpod and becoming a patron of the original cast, just like Randy did, who is now a happier, healthier, better human being. All right, here's the show.
We've gotten off the topic of the Music Man far
enough.
Yeah,
well, have we? It's all about America.
we're talking about the death of James Garfield and
Well, but that's in Assassins. We're still in.
We're still in the Broadway. Good, we made it. Thank you for calling that back.
I can always bring us back to a Broadway show. You just wait.
Whenever my world falls apart, I never lose hope or lose heart. Whatever the form of the storm that may brew, not with you to lean on, darlings, you.
Hello and welcome to The Original Cast, a podcast about original cast albums and the people who love them. I'm Patrick Flynn. My guest today has done so much. He's won Emmys. He's a former head writer of The Daily Show, head writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, best-selling comic book author, co-host of podcasts, including The Flophouse, The Who Was Podcast, and iPodius. Once conceived and pitched a Ziggy film, but I think his greatest achievement so far is that he's one of two guests on this podcast, so far, who can go to karaoke and unironically sing Weird Al Yankovic's I Lost on Jeopardy. It's Elliot Kalin, everybody!
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to be here. The use of the word best-selling for my comic book work is a little exaggerated. You know, that's a flattering input, but yeah, I did come in second place when I was on Jeopardy. It's something that still burns. It still burns deeply.
I'm sure it does. But you brag about it a lot on your other podcast.
It's the perfect humble brag because it's like, I was on Jeopardy, but I did lose. So it's like, don't worry, listeners. If you're worried, I've had lots of joys in my life. Losing on Jeopardy didn't ruin it. You know, if they'd thrown me fewer geography questions, maybe. But anyway, we don't need to.
We don't need to relitigate that.
It's not the Jeopardy Sour Grapes podcast.
Right. That's a whole other podcast. You're not here to talk about Jeopardy. You're here to talk about
The Music Man.
76 trombones hit the counterpoint. 110 cornets blazed the way. The rhythm of march, march, march. All the kids began to march, and their march is still right today.
The Music Man never come up yet on this show, which is amazing. It is one of my favorite musicals.
I was very surprised. You sent me the list of episodes that have been done already. And of course, immediately I think Sweeney Todd or Jesus Christ Superstar, because I want to seem cool, and those have been done already. But I thought about The Music Man as a show. I love it. I think the music is so fun, and it's such a like uplifting show, but it's also kind of satirical in a way that I think is easy to lose sight of. But also, during the beginning of the pandemic, we had just bought a turntable in our house, and my wife's parents gave us a bunch of their old record albums to kind of be the seed of a record collection, which we have not expanded on, but we keep meaning to. And one of those was their old copy of the original Music Man cast album. And we spent so much in the early days of the pandemic when, like, my kids didn't have school, we couldn't leave the house. We spent so much time just kind of marching around the living room to the Music Man soundtrack. And so it's got a very special place for us now. Truly how Meredith Willson meant for it to be. For it to be enjoyed as a record you listen to over and over again when you cannot leave the house because of a virus that's out there.
That last part maybe not, but I think the first part he'd be down. Pretty good. It's one of those. So when did it come into your life? How did The Music Man come into your life?
It first came into my life as seeing the movie, the old movie of it, when I was in my 20s already. I think I grew up in a Broadway going family.
I was going to say, that seems pretty late
my grandmother used to take us to a lot of Broadway shows, and she would get subscriptions to theaters. And I went to school in NYU and lived in New York for a while. So I would go to Broadway a lot, but like, I have such a vivid memory. It was such a strong impact seeing 1990 or 91 revival of Guys and Dolls with Nathan 92, Lane and 92, like going to see that and being, I think I was 10 or 11 and being like, this is amazing. Like I've never, up to then I'd seen like the Nutcracker and like A Mall and the Night Visitors and things like that, you know, like kids theater type stuff and seeing it. And from there on, it was like, oh, I love this stuff. But for some reason, The Music Man, I think probably because there just wasn't, there was that Craig Bierko revival in 2000.
Like 2000.
And by that point I was in college. And I think I was only going to see stuff that I could get really cheap tickets. I would get like at whatever the Roundabout Theater was doing, I could get very cheap tickets too. So I would go to see those productions. But for some reason, my mom was just like, hey, you ever seen The Music Man? I'm sending you the DVD of the movie. And I watched it and I was like, why haven't I seen this before? This is amazing. And it's just a really wonderful show. And so since then, I've seen the movie many times and listened to the album, like I said, a lot. But there's part of me that's like, when I was a kid, why didn't I have this? Like, I really would have liked to have had it when I was already living in a world where we were listening to the soundtracks of Fiddler on the Roof and West Side Story and Guys and Dolls and, like, all the other kind of classic Broadway shows. Like, why was this not – why did it take my mom so long? Why, mother? Why?
It's a great failing on her part.
So right? I wish I could say, really... like, oh, I grew up with The Music Man, but I kind of didn't. And there's a weird way that it feels more of a discovery of – mine in a strange way, even though my mom literally sent me the movie and was like, you should watch this. It's because I wasn't introduced to it as a kid. I knew I knew from Simpsons jokes and things like that, like 76 Strong Bones and I knew the monorail episode. It's like the idea of Harold Hill, you know, but hearing the, you know, like many things on The Simpsons when I was a kid, hearing the joke and then finally encountering the thing the joke was about and being like, oh, that's what it is. Or like Mystery Science Theater, the same thing. Like, oh, yes, that's what it is. Much. Oh, that's that's what that's a joke about. That one line of dialogue that's been in my head for 10 years.
Forever and ever.
Yeah.
And I've been laughing and I don't really know why. Yeah. It's very, I mean, because it is, it's iconic, The Music Man, which I think is why, like, but I think it's iconic in a way that modern musicals aren't being allowed to do, I think because they run for so long on Broadway, is that I encountered this show in community theater in high schools.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's where I saw it. I saw high school productions of it. I probably have seen 6 high school productions of this show.
Yeah.
When I was young.
It's a great high school show because it's got a huge cast.
Yeah.
And there's, and like the songs are, you don't have to
but
sing
there's like
that
6
well.
Parts.
Yeah. Right. And there's the, and that's one thing, I think, one of the things I think that's iconic about it is just listening to the album. Listen for this podcast, just listening through it all the way through, not dancing with a child at the same time, so I could really focus on it. It's like, oh, this show doesn't sound like any other show I could really think of. Like, in some way, like, it is so much more, like, lyric-focused than melody-focused. The lyrics don't rhyme 70% of the time. And it's so much, it is like, it feels like he saw the way Rex Harrison is in My Fair Lady and was like, yes, that is what everyone in this show will sound like most
all
of
the time.
Is like, talking this thing and we're talking a song but we're not really singing it, and it's like but it works so well, but it's like you don't see a lot of shows like it. But anyway, you're saying but it works for like kids that way too, because you don't have to have an amazing voice, you know, to do it.
And it's a hit, so people come see it, you know. It's a show that everybody knows. It's like, oh, so and so high school is doing The Music Man, oh, I'll go see that, you know. How, you know, that's gonna be, my aunt has played piano in I believe a dozen productions, and if you just
that's
start
amazing.
Humming Wells Fargo Wagon behind her, she kind of starts twitching.
The maple sugar on my birthday.
In March I got a great Mackinac.
And once I got some grapefruit from Tampa. Montgomery Ward sent me a bathtub and a cross-cut saw.
Oh, the Wells Fargo wagon is up. Blowing down is in a brief bit surprise of COD.
It could be curtains
or dishes
or a double boiler.
Or it could be.
Yes, it could be. Yes, you're right. It surely could be.
Something
very, very special now.
Just for me.
She has some great stories about the way different ways people have performed the solo lines in Wells Fargo Wagon. Which are just, you know, the great people, high school students especially, can really try to make that line, you know, that I got a box of maple sugar on my birthday. That's their moment. They're a senior and they're gonna take it.
They're gonna be remembered for this moment.
Yes, they will.
Oh, that's so funny.
It is. It's, and it's just one of those. But I was struck by looking it up on IMDb that it has been only, you know, it's been for a show that is huge. It's only been done on Broadway 4 times.
Yeah.
One of which is a Dick Van Dyke limited run they did in 1980, which I did not know about.
Oh, I wish I could have seen that. I bet he was amazing to see in it. I don't know how else the rest of it might have been, but
It's also starred a young Christian Slater as Winthrop. I would have paid to see that.
That would be interesting, I guess. Yeah,
that's some wild cat. He's more of a Tommy Gealist than a Winthrop, but you know, it was young. But I think because it lives more in the sort of community era. When they announced the new revival with Hugh Jackman, it felt kind of weird that they were doing Music Man, because I can see Music Man. You know what I mean? Like, I can find that show. And I don't – it also brings this trend, I think, of old Harold Hills. And I don't know where – Hugh Jackman strikes me as a little too old to be Harold Hill. Dick Van Dyke certainly was too old to be Harold Hill in 1980. But Robert Preston wasn't a spring chicken when he did it.
No, when he – I want to look up – when he did it, he was – yeah, he's in his – I guess he was in his late 30s. Which is still
okay,
but when he did the movie,
that's true. Everyone just looked older back then.
Yes,
I think is also.
But when he did the movie, he was in his 40s.
Yes,
and his 40s is a weird age for Harold Hill. But it's, I'm so glad he did the movie, because it's like, I want to see that performance there are parts of like 76 Trombones that I think are better in the movie than on the album. I think there are a couple times there's a couple times in the album where his voice is kind of losing it a little bit. And there are times in the I'm glad the movie exists, but you're right. It's like this character should be like a young kind of like young, arrogant, like thinks he can do anything, doesn't play by the rules guy, but he's always played by kind of like middle-aged man. And Sutton Foster is playing Marion now, right? And as much as I love Sutton Foster, like that's an older person to be playing this role of the like someone who's supposed to be a librarian, probably in her like late 20s, early 30s, I'm guessing.
It's really hard to say.
It's hard to tell.
I mean, at least I am appreciative of the fact that they cast two actors who are, I mean, Hugh Jackman's 53 and she's 47. They're at least comparable in generational terms.
It's not Hugh Jackman and who's a young person now? I can't even think of anybody.
I'm glad you jumped on this, because I was trying to do it in my head and
Hugh Jackman and Zendaya as Marion. Like, that would
there
be not
we
okay.
Go. Yeah. Well, that's your Greatest Showman connection.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I didn't realize Jefferson Mays is playing the mayor in it.
Yes. Well, that's the thing about this show, is that if you just know it from the album, you may not realize that there are great roles in this show that don't sing.
Yeah.
You know, the mayor is, I mean, I would say it's the second best role in the show, certainly for a male identifying actor. And it is. He has no songs.
Yeah.
You know, he just has funny lines,
but yeah, there's no musical songs.
And it's another great reason for the movie to exist, to have Paul Ford as Mayor Shin. And I mean, Hermione Gingold as Mrs. Shin. I mean, those characters are just like absolutely wild, and they do such a great job with it, of that great almost vaudevillian style characters that they are.
It's so funny, and there's so much, like, I think that, I mean, I haven't seen the current revival of it. I'd like to see it, but it's not, you know, I feel like now is not the climate where I feel like I'm going to get on a plane just to see a Broadway show,
right?
You know, and also expensive. Who does that? That'd be crazy.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, people do that, but it's nuts.
People do that.
Yeah. I could see, like, actually, there's no. I'm like. I guess if the Marx Brothers were reviving Coconuts or I'll Say She Is or on Broadway, but that's, then I would definitely fly over. But I'm not gonna.
Well, yes. If someone revived the Marx Brothers,
if they came back from the dead, I'd do that. But I still regret that. I regret that I didn't go to London to see any of the Monty Python 02 revival shows when they did.
Yeah.
Because everyone was like, of course they're gonna come to New York after this, but they didn't, because nobody knew Terry Jones was so ill. But from the reviews of the Hugh Jackman one, it feels like this one might not recognize – like, it recognizes that the show is funny, but it might not recognize how bitingly funny the show is. That, like, the show is a – everything keeps saying about nostalgia in the reviews I've read. And I think what comes across to me, at least in the movie a little bit, but especially in the cast album, is like, this is a show that is old now, but it is about a time much older, and it is – constantly poking fun at that time in the way, and not in the way of like things were silly back then when people did that, because the people making the show remembered that time. Like, Meredith Wilson's writing about a time when he was young. And so, like, that it is the same way that Singing in the Rain is such an amazing movie in many ways, but also that it is such a sharp comedy about life in Hollywood in the 20s, a time when the people making the movie remembered. Like, when they made that movie in the 50s, it wasn't like, oh, the silent era, that was the, you know, dinosaur times. So, like, so Meredith Wilson can be like, hey, remember in the 19-teens how goofy this stuff was? Like, remember how excited we were about that Wells Fargo wagon? That was ridiculous. Like, remember how crazy it seemed when people were drinking near beer? Like, this is, like, that seemed so bad at the time. But now, like, there's something so satirical in it people don't kind of see right nowadays as much.
And that's all the breakdown, whatever you want to call that breakdown section in the middle of You Got Trouble is, when he's going over the warning signs of the telltale signs of corruption. You know, it's constant references to that period of time and what could be thought of as like rebuckling knickerbockers below the knee. Like, and I imagine in 1957 that got quite a good laugh.
Mothers of River City, heed that warning before it's too late. Watch for the telltale signs of corruption. The minute your son leaves the house, does he rebuckle his knickerbockers below the knee? Is there a nicotine stain on his index finger? A dime novel hidden in the corn crib? Is he starting to memorize jokes from Cap'n Billy's whiz bag? Are certain words creeping into his conversation? Words like swell. And so's your old man. What if so, my friends? You got trouble.
He mentions quoting jokes from Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, and like that was a real magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people who are like, it's like now if he was like, if he's like repeating all the lines Urkel has on TGIF, like the audience would be like, ha, I remember that. Like that's the equivalent, you know.
Yeah.
And but now when we watch it, it's just like, antiquated. I remember reading a thing, and they were like, that was a real magazine. He's referencing a real thing. It's like, of course he is. That's what's funny about it to that audience. And but now it's just kind of this mush of. I think there's a lot of people. The older something gets, the harder it is for people to see that the time in between when it's set, when it was created, and eventually The Music Man, it'll be 100 years, or it'll be 300 years from now, and it'll be like when, with Shakespeare plays, where it's like, a lot of people, I think, don't realize that Shakespeare plays, a lot of them are not set in Shakespeare time, that like, Hamlet is set long ago in the past, you know? But, or Macbeth is set a long, long time ago. They're like, this is what people talked like in Shakespeare days. But, it's too bad to lose some of that. But I'm curious to see this new revival, because it feels like that's so clear in the cast album, but I don't know how they handle it in the new one. So this is your this is your uninformed Broadway beat reporter, Elliot Kalin, talking about shows he hasn't seen.
Like every true theater fan, expounding opinions about things he knows nothing about.
Oh, movie fans too. That's the best thing about being a movie fan.
Oh, that's true.
Is you can talk about movies you've never seen as if you know all about them, you know?
Well, I guess where were you in your 20s? You were already on sort of the comedy path, right? You were on your path to being something, maybe not knowing exactly what you wanted to do, but you were in comedy. Correct?
Yes, very much. I knew I always wanted to be a writer since I was probably like 6 or 7. And I wanted to be and I gravitated toward, and growing up, it was the golden age of stand-up comedy on television. Like, there were so many stand-up comedy shows on MTV and on VH1 and on Comedy Central. And so I was just always watching stand-up comedy, to a lesser extent, sketch comedy. And of course, I was a kid. So, like, whatever stuff was on television during the day, whatever sitcoms or bad cartoons or syndicated old shows, I was watching. But so by this time, I was in college and I was already writing and starting to write and perform sketch comedy very primitively, and I was like the kid who's like submitting comedy writing to like the New Yorker and getting rejected. Cause of course I was like 17 years old. Like there's no, you know, but was like, knew I could write funny things. Like I would write funny things for like the school newspaper and stuff like that. And then, I was in college for screenwriting, but I wanted to be involved in comedy in some way. And but at the same time, there was such darkness in me, such serious darkness, you know,
such Travis Bickle darkness in
exactly the Travis Bickle darkness. But so at that time, it was, I think I was keyed in more to pick up the humor of it than anything else, you know. And there was just something about it's such a funny show, like that whole Rock Island song in the beginning where they're on the train.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, the other thing that I grew up on was Gilbert and Sullivan, and it reminds me so much of that.
Oh, like, yeah.
In my house, mm-hmm. my mother was constantly playing Doily Cart Opera Company CDs of, you know, HMS mm-hmm. Pinafore, Pirates of Penzance, and my grandmother loves that stuff. And my grandmother was like very much my gateway to culture, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, she would take mm-hmm. me to see old movies, she would take me to see. I guess she doesn't use them now because she's very elderly, but she had season tickets to the Metropolitan Opera for many, many years. And so, and she would take different grandchildren to different operas. And as the grandchildren got older and lost interest in opera, or wouldn't sit through it, I would get to see more and more. She'd be like, your cousin doesn't want to go see this Czech opera. Do you want to go see it? Sure. Yeah, of course I do. But,
here's Yennefer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and, it ruined me for opera, though, because my grandmother had very good seats. She most of my life, it was second row seats at the Met. And then eventually she upgraded to first row seats. And she's like, this man with the big hair has been sitting in front of me for years. And he finally stopped his subscription, so I'm taking that seat. And every now and then my wife and I, we would get tickets to see operas ourselves. And we'd be sitting so far back or up in the balcony. I'd be like, well, I can't see how sweaty they are. This is not working for me. But that Gilbert and Sullivan vibe of like very funny, like lyric writing and very, but like fast and, you know, there's that song. I just think it's very funny that and instantly the song is like, it's a show that is nostalgic for an earlier time period. And it opens with a song of people talking about how nostalgic they are for an even earlier time period. When you would mm-hmm. like, oh, there goes the Cracker Barrel. They want right. biscuits in packages now. Like it's mm-hmm. so funny to me that the nested nostalgia that this show is all about. But just right from the beginning of it, it's like this is a funny show. There's going to be a love story in it, and there's going to be like some serious stuff. And the serious songs in it are very kind of the more generic ones, except for like Till There Was You, you know, which is a gorgeous song, and Good Night, My Someone, I think is a really beautiful song. But there's like mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's like, look, these are going to be funny songs. We're going to be doing funny songs here. And as a television writer, I've gotten to write lyrics for a lot of songs. And I'm constantly, depending on the musician, some musicians are better, I can work with better than others at this. I'm constantly kind of frustrated with musicians and butting heads a little bit because I don't really care if the lyrics sound good or are beautiful or if the music sounds like, you know, I'm quoting in my fingers, good music. I want the lyrics to be funny. And a lot of times, like, and I feel like with this show, which Meredith Willson is like, I'm going to have these funny lyrics, then I'm going to fit music to it. Or I'm going to write music, and I'm going to have the funny lyrics kind of around the songs. But it's not this this feeling of like, I'm going to try to get some jokes in there. But really, we've got to follow the sacred rules of songwriting and make these songs as melodically beautiful as possible to really register the instrument that is the human voice, you know, or whatever. So, I don't know. That's a long way of saying I think it's a funny show.
Well, that's – well, it's pretty funny. Yeah. But it is the interesting thing about a lot of the songs that and you know, I think the show among music theater snobs gets a bad rap. Because it famously beat West Side Story at the Tony Awards mm-hmm. that year. And, you know, that's fine. I don't think either show was affected really by that experience in the long run.
It's just too bad. And more people might know about West Side Story if it had gotten that boost, like, you know.
Specifically
Whatever
today.
Happened to that show? Whatever happened? Oh, nobody talks about it anymore.
Nobody talks about it anymore. But, of course, the interesting things about it, listening to it this time, was I recognized, like you're talking about with the lyrics, how much it follows all the things that like Stephen Sondheim talks about in his books about songwriting, which is the lyrics for music theater have to be clearly understood.
Mm-hmm.
So your word choice has to be suited to the music. You have to hit, you know, open vowels on high notes and things like that. But you also have to make sure you're using words that are easy to follow, rhyme or not. The flow has to work so that your ear can pick up what's going on as it goes. And this show is that from top to bottom.
Yeah.
With probably the exception of My White Knight, which is, I think, universally regarded as the lowest moment in the show.
My white knight, not a Lancelot, nor an angel with wings, just someone to love me, who is not ashamed of a few nice things. My white knight,
Shapoopy notwithstanding.
Oh, I mean, well, that's, if you're, Shapoopy, I barely consider a song. It's at this point, like, it's such, I have, so, that's, it's such a, anytime, and like, when I get to that part of the movie, I'll just skip it. Like, I hate it so much. I don't like
oh,
it.
Oh, even Buddy Hackett's sort of wild, crazed delivery straight to the camera.
I just, I mean, that, I like that Buddy Hackett's doing it. I like him.
Yeah.
But it's, the song sounds bad. It's a bad message. Yeah. The lyrics are just like everything about it, and also that it's making up a term, and the term doesn't sound like the thing it's supposed to be describing.
Now a woman will kiss on the very first date is usually a hussy, and a woman will kiss on the second time out anything but fussy, but a woman will wait till the third time around, head in the clouds, feet on the ground. She's a girl you're glad you found. She's your Shapoopy, 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 Shapoopy.
The girl is hard to get.
Shapoopy, Shapoopy, Shapoopy.
But you can't win her yet.
I did some research before. I was like, I gotta find out. Like, I gotta just double check that Shapoopy wasn't a real word that people used.
Sure.
And it's not. It's a made up word for the thing. And it's like, it's such a dumb. It's everything about it is so misconceived. And the other song, and the White Knight song is just kind of like, all right, this is just kind of like, this could be in any show. This could be anything.
Do you know the? Do you know the lore behind My White Knight?
No.
So the legend is that Music Man was out of town. Pretty much as is, but without My White Knight. And Frank Lesser came to see the show. There was some other song there in that position, I believe, as the story goes.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Lesser went to see the show. And then the next day came around to Meredith Willson's hotel and handed him My White Knight and said, here, this is what your show needs. Put this in as the romantic number. And he did. I mean, obviously, My White Knight is a song in there. And didn't want credit and didn't want any of that. And what then that legend, I think, got a lot of traction because it was replaced. It's the only song that's replaced in the movie.
Uh-huh.
And except for a little, the All I Want is a Plain Man, All I Want is a Quiet Man section. So the legend is that Meredith Willson wrote that part and then Frank Lesser wrote the rest of it. I don't know if it's true. It's a great story. I don't know if it's,
this is a
it's
good
true
story,
or not.
The idea that, like, Frank Lesser brought me a song. Like, I can't say no to him. Like, this,
I guess I got a no to Frank Lesser.
I guess, right? I got
to
put it in. But it's like the same way that, like, there was, I was doing a years and years ago, I was making a thing for The Daily Show that Larry David was doing the voiceover for. And he was like, and we were recording a voiceover, and he goes, just the first draft of it, knowing it was going to be rewritten at some point, he was like, oh, you should put this part in. You should put, you should have him say something like this, say a joke like this. Mm. And we were like, okay, like, we don't, it doesn't really work with what we're doing, but like Larry David said it. And then we recorded it, and he goes, oh, I noticed you put that joke in. You didn't just put that in because I told you to put it in, did you? And we're like, no, it's, we really liked it. We liked it. Okay, great. And then we cut it out of the edit, and we just didn't. But it was like, but it was that kind of thing where, like, if the right person comes to you and says, you need to put this in, you're like, okay, like, I can't say no to Larry David, like, in this comedy moment, like, Meredith Wilson's like, I can't say no to Frank Lesser. Like, he's gonna go to the show and he's gonna see what's not
right
in there.
He's gonna see. And well, it's not like, I mean, it would be like if Larry David showed up to you and delivered,
yeah,
like,
that's
this
true.
Is what I'm gonna say, and you'd be like, oh, okay, thanks, Larry. Because I imagine for him, that's a weird sort of collaboration moment where he's just like thinking he's a comic pitching jokes, and you guys are like, that's Larry David, like. I guess we'll just do what Larry David wants to do.
It was really he was either, at first it seemed like, okay, we got to do what he has to do. But then when he came back and he was like, you didn't put that in just because I told you, it was like he was understanding the dynamic in a way that he hadn't understood before, that we were just two schmoes who work on this other show and he's Larry David. And like, and also being like, not wanting it to be that way. That like, he wants that joke in there if we think it's funny. And he wanted to know that we thought it was funny. Like, he doesn't want to be given a sop. But at the same time, it would probably hurt his feelings a little bit if we were like,
a little bit.
It's not
good.
We don't
want
to put it in. Although now that I look back, if there was anyone who would be able to roll with it eventually, it's probably Larry David.
Yeah, like, probably Larry David. Yeah.
But at the time, as a young man who was way below him, as I still am on the totem pole of Hollywood, you know. So I can understand if Frank Lesser's I'm going to that Marx Brothers show. Frank Lesser comes up to me. He goes, "You should put this in your show." I'd be like, "Okay, yeah, of course, I got to do it." So they brought back the Marx Brothers. They brought back Frank Lesser.
This is quite a resurrection machine you've got rolling over there.
No, and they picked just the right people to use it on first. Yeah.
Right. The Marx Brothers and Frank Lesser. Oh my gosh, what a combination. Mm-hmm. He can rewrite Baby It's Cold Outside. Finally, we can get the
we can fix that.
The nation has been crying.
That's
for.
One of those it's so funny. Every now and then there's one of those cultural scandals, I guess, where it's like, do I need a strong opinion on Baby It's Cold Outside? I've gone years without encountering this song. Like, is it something I really need to, like, you don't want to sing it? I understand. That's fine. Oh, you like it? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Like, I can understand if people were mad when that was a huge song, when that was an enormous song, you couldn't get away from it, but it's just
I think it gets lumped into the general people don't like Christmas music.
Yes, that
discourse,
too.
And it's one where you can have a good reason not to like a song, so it gets banged.
It's also, I'm going to say this. This is might be controversial. This would be even more controversial than my statement on Shapoopy and how much I think. How much I don't like it. I think Baby It's Cold Outside, I've never heard it performed in a way that didn't sound smug. That didn't sound like the performers were real smug and were like, we're being so witty. This is so cute.
Yeah,
like this is. Aren't we adorable? And it's always like, ugh, no, thank you.
Because wasn't there a John Travolta, Olivia Newton-John version a couple years ago where they switched parts?
Yes, yeah, to make it okay.
Oh, man, that was... Well, but it was... I don't know if songs can jump sharks, but that certainly felt like I'm like, we're done.
Yeah,
we should put that one away for a little while.
That was Frank Lester came out of the machine. The revival machine was like, you know what? I think that
like,
song's
shut
over.
It down. Right, just shut it down. Right, just shut it down. It's fine, guys. Don't worry about it. I have other songs. You may have heard of most.
There's a lot of them. It's a deep catalog. I'm not.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm doing okay. Right. People don't really know I wrote this song. They just know like they know me for other things. It's fine. But I also noticed in listening to this from Wilson, sort of one of the genius things about it is there's this pervasive theme throughout the show that music is kind of magical.
Yes.
You know, music brings joy. Music brings life. Music brings happiness. And but he never really explicitly states that. You know, Harold Hill doesn't have a big speech about how music.
You know,
is
everybody,
the thing that binds
there's
us
one thing that can break down the walls between human hearts. I'm telling you, one just thing. It's music. I'm telling those each of those notes is a bullet out of a gun, knocking down enemies. Pow, 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 and those enemies are hate, disagreement, disenfranchisement. Like that's there's no scene like that, which I'm glad about. And
very glad.
Yeah, and there's something that in it comes through much more. It's funny because in the soundtrack, you just hear like the barbershop quartet type stuff. And it means you don't have the scene where he's teaching them how to sing, and like there's the it's such a powerful thing how like he goes, you know, singing is just slow talking, and he teaches these guys who don't like him how to sing, and for the rest of the movie, that's all they can do is sing together,
they
and they love it,
and they
can say things to people in a way that they couldn't express before, and even like the word he uses, he goes, just say the word ice cream, it's like it's a word that just means pure delight, like and just joy, and like. You're right, it's woven all throughout it how music is the thing that lightens people's hearts, you know? But without someone saying it, you know.
Well, and even at the beginning with like Rock Island, like it just comes out like music, the rhythm of it just comes out of the train and then creates the sequence. And like you reminded me, the Goodnight My Someone is just really it's a piano lesson that she sings on top of. That there's so many moments where the music just kind of emerges out of the ground and really prepares you for that wonderful, wonderful ending.
Yeah.
Which is just so great. Everybody playing so badly and everybody loving it because it is great. It's really great.
And being so proud of it. Like the one thing I don't like in the ending is, and on the soundtrack at least, there's that finale where they're like kind of trading off lines from the songs. And just the way it's recorded with echoes, it makes it sound like it's what's rolling through Professor Harold Hill's head as he falls into a coma,
descends into madness.
Like there's something descends into madness. There's something kind of scary about it. But yeah, that the ending is not. And I feel like this is there's this tightrope of satire and genuine like nostalgia sweetness, and it lands it so well. The fact that like the town comes together, he does make a town band. They're terrible, and like the end, but everyone loves it. And then you have like. In the movie, at least, like you then see them playing and you hear the soundtrack version, and it's like they've kind of willed themselves through their own imagination into being a band, and it's like that.
Yeah.
You don't have to be. I think it's such a beautiful message. It's like you don't have to be good at music to do music and to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, you can be bad at it and it's still fun to do, which is a huge, huge uplift for me because I can't sing. And I'm not good at music, but I'm going to do it anyway. And like this, but I spend so much of my time singing.
You dedicate large portions of the Flophouse to singing. Oh, so I imagine you certainly have a passion for it.
Because it's purely joyful, you know, and it's and it annoys other people. And that gives me joy also.
And that's your two favorite things.
Yeah.
But there is also this another thing that runs through this show is this dual identity of everybody, that that everybody is one thing and then another. You know, there's every character pretty much is introduced by someone else to someone else in the third person. So like from Harold Hill in the first scene, Charlie Cowell, which is the role I played when I did it in college, gives this long speech, but tells us who Harold Hill is, and then we meet him, and then we see what he does. Tommy Gielis is another, like, the mayor gives this long screed about how he's from the wrong side of town and all that stuff, and then we see him behave in a way that is both those things at the same time. We see him set off a firecracker at the thing. Obviously, that's bad kid behavior, but he's also pretty crafty, and he genuinely loves the daughter, so he's got, you know, there's a lot to him.
Another thing, I love that, I love how that character is like, he's a smart bad kid. He's like he's not Bart Simpson, you know. He's not like he's not like you know, the mean bully or something like that. He's like, he's a kid who has no outlet, so he causes mischief. But yeah, then he's like, I invented this thing so we can hold the music while we're walking, and it's like, that's amazing, like that's great, you know.
Right.
But you're right, and even Marion, you hear about Marion before you see her, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We see her, you hear about her, and then you see her, and she doesn't. We sort of see her behind closed doors. Yeah. Then we get the full report on her and pick a little talk again is like hilarious.
Oh yes, that woman made brazen overtures with a gilt edge guarantee. She had a golden glint in her eye and a silver voice with a counterfeit ring. Just melt her down and you'll reveal a lump of lead as cold as steel here where a woman's heart should be. He left River City, the library building, but he left all the books to her. Chaucer,
but the whole thing about Marion for Harold Hill is he's wrong about her every single time they meet each other, and she's wrong about him. And it's only as the show goes on and they see what they do to each other. I mean, because the moment that breaks my heart in the movie, because it's such a much more of a cinema moment than a stage moment, though it is glorious on stage, is when Winthrop runs downstage at the end of Wells Fargo Wagon and has that long speech, beautifully written, full of S's, about his coronet.
Yeah.
And you see in the movie Shirley Jones just disintegrate in this like moment where her brother has completely come alive.
Yeah.
And all because of this guy who she knows is a fraud on some level, because she knows she has this thing from the book, knows he didn't graduate from his bona fides aren't real.
Yeah. And so, also anyone who's really paying attention to him could probably tell from the start that he's
right
a con
from
man.
The jump.
Like almost instantly. Everything about him is slimy. We just recorded a Flophouse talking about the new death in Venice. Or no, Death Venice. The new Death on the Nile. Not Death.
Death
Venice.
On the Nile.
Death on the Nile.
Yeah.
Death in Venice is a very different story than Death on the Nile.
Very different story,
And just like,
you never read it till I bought it for you.
Yeah. But that Death on the Nile, how incredibly obvious the bad guy is from the moment you see him. He's so slimy. Man. And not to spoil it for anybody, but it's like, and with The Music Man, it's similar. It's like, you got to be bending over so bad. And I guess that's part of the joke of the show, is these people are so, there's such, they're supposed that, you know, he sees them as such rubes, obviously, but that they're so unsophisticated that they don't notice that he is everything about him is totally made up, and but that she can see through it.
Yeah.
But yeah, but you're right, that moment where she knows this is a con, but this is a con that means so much to her brother and has brought something into his life that he never knew before, which means so much to him. And so what does that mean? How does she process that? And like, how can she feel? How can she just hate this guy when he's done this thing for her brother that's so special, you know? And it's such a, and at the same time, and every time when Harold Hill's singing like the Sadder But Wiser Girl, and it's like, you don't really feel that way. Like, it's clear you would like someone that you can fall in love with. Like, this is
right.
Like,
yeah.
You don't really want a floozy that you can sleep with and then go away, you know?
Right. But that's not what he's saying exactly. What he's saying is, so there's an overarching, like, there's a grand unifying theory I have about The Music Man, because I think too much about things, where, and this is not my original, the big reveal in this theory is not my original idea. I heard this from somebody else, but it plays for me, because in Sadder But Wiser Girl, what he's really, you're right, I mean, he's talking about a woman with experience, a woman who has lived.
He's a woman he doesn't want a woman who is, he doesn't want the pure virginal maiden that he's supposed to, in 1911, he's supposed to.
In 1911, he was supposed to care for her. He doesn't want Ethel Toffelmeyer.
Yeah.
No bright-eyed, blushing, breathless baby doll baby.
No, sir, that kind of child ties knots no sailor ever knew. I prefer to take a chance on a more adult romance. No dewy young miss who keeps resisting all the time she keeps insisting. No bright-eyed, wholesome, innocent female. No, sir, why, she's the fisherman, I'm the fish, you see. Plop, I flinch, I shile. When the lass with the delicate air walks by, I smile, I grin. When the gal with the touch of sin walks in, I hope and I pray for Hester to win just one more A. The sadder but wiser girl's the girl for me. The sadder but wiser girl for me.
But the basic sort of conspiracy theory underneath the Music Man that people in music theater circles love to talk about is the idea that Winthrop is actually Marion's son. I don't know if you've heard this.
No,
before.
I haven't. But it makes that, I could see it. I mean, it's a way of darkening it. It makes sense in a way.
That
yeah.
What's the guy's name? Madison is Winthrop's father, and Marion is Winthrop's mother.
It's a real Jack Nicholson situation.
It is, it, to a certain extent, yeah. But it does. I've heard that espoused as a joke. I've heard it poo-pooed by people who I've offended more than one fan of the Music Man by suggesting that it might be true.
How dare you? Well, I think that's very funny too, because it's like, that's not the Marion I know. When like,
well, and it's the very not? Like, well, just because he's so much younger, my mother had me when I was like, no. That's not what I'm saying. But it is like,
you have to remember at that time it was very common for blah blah blah.
I get a lot of that. But what I'm more thinking of is I like the idea that for Marion as a character, either truth can be true. What she says about Uncle Maddie, as she calls him, like being a benefactor, a friend of her father who took care of them and all that sort of thing. That can be true. But it can also be true that she had this life experience. She loved a man who was much older than her. Would have been very frowned upon in the town they live in. They had a son together. That would have obviously also been tremendously frowned upon, but there was a way they could cloak it. But it has given her this experience. It has hardened her as a person that when Harold Hill comes in and she knows he has a secret and is not everything he claims to be, there is a mutual connection there.
I like that.
It's like we're all lying. We're all not quite telling the truth, but that doesn't mean we're not good people. That doesn't mean we don't want good things, you know, that kind of stuff.
It's fun as a theory. If someone did a production where that was explicit, I might be like, I don't know.
But
I like it as a theory because I think you're getting it. It's like, so when he's singing The Sadder But Wiser Girl, he doesn't know he's singing about Marion, but he is.
Yes,
and
exactly.
When she's singing about her white knight, it's because that's the opposite of the experience she's had. You know, it's not... Yeah. What's her name in Guys and Dolls singing about, meet him when the time.
Yeah, when
you
time
have
is right.
To
yeah,
yourself yeah. A Scarsdale yeah. Galahad, you know.
Right.
The breakfast-eating Brooks Brothers type. Like, it's not right. Someone who doesn't know anything else in life and is projecting a fan. It's someone who's like, I just want my white knight. I've been through this. This is not what life has given me. I want someone who's just going to take care of me and stay with me rather than, you know. Who wants me?
Yeah. I mean, it's the real feel. Like the thing I like about My White Knight is that she's singing like, I just want somebody who wants me. And if occasionally he thinks about the things that I think about too, that would be great.
Yeah.
But really, I just want him to want me more than he wants everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful. Like that's a really nice. You know, I wish the song was better, but it's a beautiful.
it's a beautiful intention. As opposed to So then it goes a little bit of Shapoopy, which is a bad song with a bad intention. So My White Knight is a bad song with a good intention. You know,
that's true. I guess yes, you would have to put Shapoopy. Shapoopy gets convicted on for cause.
You can prove cause and motivation on that one. This is not a
yeah.
You know, the Shapoopy the House Committee on Shapoopy really made its case that Shapoopy was intending the things that it was saying. You know.
Senator, oh my! I can't even imagine.
What did the man sing after that? He said to give her a squeeze when she wasn't looking, and if you got a squeeze back, that's fancy cooking. Okay, I think our case is closed. Thank you for your time,
Mr. Wolfington. What did you mean by fancy cooking? Did you enumerate that? I would like to remind the committee I didn't write this song; I just performed it on Broadway.
It's not my words. It's a character I played.
Right. Yes, but we used the resurrection machine to bring back all the people it's allowed. Now we can't bring back Meredith Wilson, so here you sit.
Yeah, we ran out. We did. We brought you back before Meredith Wilson. Right. We ran out of slots. We should have. Brought him back. Yeah, but
we should to answer these questions.
But yeah, so Iggy, if you could tell us what it was about, right. Like
what is the fancy cooking exactly? Because it is such a. But it really, songs like that in shows like this fascinate me because they are purely functional. It really reveals the thing that makes a Broadway show or a live show, forget Broadway show, a live show different from a film is that the reason Shapoopy exists is to kick off Act Two with a bang, mm-hmm. to get our energy way up because we're going to get into a lot of slow romantic plot stuff and we need to. We ended on Wells Fargo Wagon. We can't just like slump into Act Two. We have to jump into it.
Yeah.
So here we go.
And I assume also to give Robert Preston a little break, instead of having him do the high energy number, give it to his sidekick so that he can, because he's been busting himself all act, and he's still got. Does he have any other big stuff after that? I don't remember.
He has a lot of scenes, but he really takes Act Two because he dances in Shapoopy usually. Comes in at the end of Shapoopy, dances with Marion, but he doesn't sing again until there was you at the end of the act, virtually.
Because at that point, you have to assume that after doing You Got Trouble and 76 Trombones and the Sad Herbert Weiser, like it's a
and
lot
Sad Herbert Weiser Grove
from
big yeah.
songs from him in the beginning. And you have to now imagining. Meredith Wilson is like, has a song for Robert Preston in that act. And Robert Preston's like, my voice can't handle it. Meredith,
right,
you got to put something else in there.
You got
to put something else. Well, I do have this. I do have this song that I threw away as soon as I wrote it.
Right.
Put it in there.
As I was writing it, I was erasing it. It was a really weird experience.
I should say, musically, it's not a bad song. The only issue I have with it is with the lyrics. And I mean, musically, it's not an amazing song. It's certainly not. It's another one where it's like
it's functional.
Yeah, it's functional. Yeah. Exactly. But it's if it was about something else. I mean, I just remember when I first watched this first time, just being so thinking the term Shapoopy was so strange. Like it's not.
Yeah.
It just does. It's not a word that sounds like what it's supposed to be communicating. And you watch it, and it is one of those times where the show stops, and it's literally like, and this character is performing the song for the other characters. So it's not like So it's like. I get what you're saying. Like you got to start that act with energy, but then it's like,
right.
what's going on with this show? Like where's the show going? Hold on.
Yeah. But that's the, if you look at, so especially from this period, I mean, you look at Broadway shows from like you feel like that's a weird time to have a song or why does this character get to sing in this moment? It is 9 times out of 10 because, like you said, the lead needs to sit down.
Yeah.
You know, we need to give Ethel Merman a break. That's why we have All I Need Is the Girl. Now, All I Need Is the Girl is a great song, but it is like that. That's the reason this character who we haven't heard before suddenly has a dance, big dance solo.
It reminds me of, there was years ago, I went to see Loretta Lynn perform because I think she's amazing. And her voice was astounding. I don't know how old she is now. This was probably 10 years ago. So she was already in like her 70s, I think. And her voice sounded great. But there's a certain point in the show where she goes, I got to sit down. My backup boys are going to take some time for me. So I got to. And she just sat on a chair on stage while her backup singers did a couple songs. And it was like, you know what, Loretta? We get it.
Yeah.
Go for it. Like this is. Uh-huh. And then she got back up and she did, you know, a bunch of her. She only sang her hits. I remember someone requested. She goes, someone was yelling out a song from the album she did that Jack White produced. And she turns.
Oh, sure.
And she turns to that woman in the audience. She goes, honey, I don't remember any of my new songs. That was so funny, but it's like, but I get it. Like, if you're the performer that the whole show is resting on, it takes a colossal amount of energy to not have to take that time, and you want to build it into the show so that the second act is not, you're not dealing with a performer who's flagging, you know, through it.
Yeah, because they got to do it again tomorrow.
Yes,
like they got to do it 8 times
that
a week.
Day sometimes,
like,
yeah.
I'm always fascinated from a writing standpoint of like all those little decisions you have to make. In a musical, because it's live and it's on stage, and we, like you said, we have to give characters a break. We have to slide things over. We have to change the set. It's my favorite example of that is in Guys and Dolls for, I think it's Sumi. Yeah, it is Sumi. That's right. That's the one that Nathan Detroit and his fiancée sing down. They sing it down in front of the curtain because behind them they're changing the set from the crapshooter to the prayer hall, and like they just needed like 10 minutes to do that. So they give him like this comedy scene and song, which then was cut from subsequent productions because people were like, well, it was just written to change the set and we can do that faster now. And then reinstated in the 92 production because it is actually hilariously funny
it's a really good song.
Yeah.
I never knew that they removed it from the other version because it's a really funny moment.
It was removed from the next revival was, took it out. And then it kind of like, it was in and out for a while, but 92 kind of slammed it right back in and people don't cut that anymore.
That 92 production was just like so, like, and I went into it as a kid, so I didn't know, I had no other versions of Guys and Dolls to compare it to, but like, but just seeing it, it was like, oh, this is like, this, it was like, it was hard, it's hard for me to imagine like a better introduction for a kid like me to Broadway, to see that production and be like, it's super funny.